This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Yep, Lemon, it's Monday.
Oh, my God. I feel it. It feels it. Interesting. I kind of had to go out and about for a medical thing and or dental thing. That experience was good. I went to a store or so, and, they're being very, very careful, but I can see how you can quickly tip into like, yep. Oh my God, I'm out.
Yeah, totally. Well, and reopening, that is the word of the day for
yes.
Sure. And how it's going and the effect on the virus is important. Joe Nocera is with us. I am very lucky because it's the second time today I've gotten to talk to him. How lucky am I? He joins us on the phone from Florida. Mr. Nocera, you are seeing this up close and personal in terms of one state's reaction. And as you often are, you've got a little bit of a different take. What are you seeing?
Well, here in Boca Raton, let's face it, it's filled with New Yorkers. Everybody's wearing a mask. I was at Williams-Sonoma yesterday, and I asked somebody what would happen if some person came in without a mask, and they told me that corporate had told them that they need to ask that person to leave and that they would try and help them from behind a closed door. So it's not like the people that I see, many of whom are elderly, by the way, this is Florida, South Florida, are all wearing masks, they're all doing the right thing, so on and so forth. But there's no question this is a huge spike in Florida. I think the governor is correct in ascribing a fair amount of that to young people who are, crowding into the bars without masks, without social distancing, and spreading virus. The startling number is that the average age of a person with a positive case has dropped from 62 to 34. So that pretty much tells you what's going on here. And the governor has responded by closing the bars. And when he does his daily thing, like Cuomo used to do, he's always talking about masks and social distancing and washing your hands and the importance of all of that. But he hasn't mandated masks, which is something that, for instance, the mayor of Miami has done, and Miami's also closed down the beaches for July 4th for the July 4th holiday weekend. So, here's the thing, Jason. Take a look at California. California numbers are going up just as fast as Florida numbers are,
yeah.
And just as fast as Texas numbers are. The virus does not care whether you're a progressive governor or a Trump-loving governor. It really doesn't. And it appears to me more and more that just the act of reopening spreads the virus, no matter how much you try to prevent that from happening. If we lived in a society where 100% of the people wore masks and 100% of the people practiced social distancing all the time, maybe we'd be in better shape. But we don't live in that kind of society. And so this is kind of the price we're paying.
Well, so, Joe, here's the deal. I think so many of us are like finger wagging at Florida saying, see what you're doing, see what you've created. I mean, how should we look at what's happening either in Florida or some of the other states where we're seeing numbers go up? I mean, are they doing something wrong or not necessarily because maybe hospitalizations aren't going up as much or and those that are
right.
More vulnerable are actually quarantining while those that aren't so vulnerable are going out and about. And that's a more realistic way of kind of getting back to normal and reopening our economy.
Right. So here's the problem. What the epidemiologists say is that you should get your R number below one. That means that every person who has it gives it to fewer than one person statistically. But no state is really willing to do that, not even New York. New York's at 1.02, which is pretty good. Florida's like at 1.53. Texas is like 1.8. California's 1.5. Because if they wait that long, they worry about businesses shutting down, about the economy getting worse and worse. So there's an anxiety to open up the society as quickly as possible to get economic activity back up and running. So I think you could make a scientific case that almost every state has reopened too early, according to the hard and fast epidemiological recommendation. But this is the consequence that we're facing now, is because people are giving it to more than one person, and the numbers are going up. The flip side is, if it truly is all younger people, there will be less death and less hospitalizations because younger people are more vulnerable to it. Some of them are asymptomatic, and you could survive in that kind of situation. So, Florida has actually done a very good job of protecting the nursing homes, much better than New York, and they've been many, many fewer deaths among the elderly. So every state has a kind of a mixed bag of things they've done well, things they've done wrong. The progressives have had a great deal of fun sort of blasting the red state governors, and the red state governors have had a great deal of fun saying, see, our numbers are lower than yours, even though, on and on and on. It's ridiculous. Everybody should be trying to figure out the best way to reopen that'll kill the fewest numbers of people.
Yeah. All right. Well, thought-provoking as always. Joe Nocera joining us on the phone, Bloomberg opinion columnist, best-selling author, host of the award-winning podcast, The Shrink Next Door, which has a new bonus episode dropping next week, I believe. So check that out. It's also going to be an Apple movie, Apple TV movie, starring Paul Rudd and Will Ferrell. Can't wait for all of that.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
This is one of these, I'm just rubbing my hands. So excited to get some time with these guys. Josh Green is just one of the guys you want to hear from at a time like this, especially as this election really heats up. He's got a great story in the magazine. In Role Swap, Trump runs as an outsider. Biden plays incumbent. Josh joins us on the phone, as does Joel Weber. He is, of course, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. So, Joel, I think you feel the same way I do. You just want to know what Josh Green has to say about all this, right?
We do, but I also want to just say that, we got this story in, and then the art department came up with some art that was just phenomenal. And we were also like, do we need the words anymore? So, as great as Joshua is, the art department can sometimes be even better. But, the conceit really started with Josh, which was, obviously the presidential race being what it is and the times being what they are. It's almost like the president as an incumbent and Biden have almost switched places, it seems, where Biden's actually running like the incumbent might, whereas Trump has maintained this sort of outsider persona almost, despite actually being in charge of the federal government. So Josh, as you sort of dug into this, one of the things that really stood out to me was the number of authoritative people you've talked to who have advised other presidential campaigns in the past. And I'm really curious, what were the things that stood out to you as you were reporting this?
Well, overall what stood out was just the oddity of this race. But the specific thing that seemed so odd, as we talked about, is that these two guys have sort of just swapped roles. So in speaking to past presidential strategists, administration officials, Trump officials, it really has to do with the unique nature of these two men. I mean, on the one hand, Donald Trump, loves being a Kennedy, loves holding stadium rallies and tweeting and criticizing people, but he's never really kind of cottoned to running the government. And when you look at all that's going wrong in the country, from the spread of COVID to the recession and the collapse of the stock market and all these other things, it's kind of understandable why he might not want to focus on that and run the way a traditional president would, which is having lots of Rose Garden ceremonies and reminding people that he's the president and he's in charge. On the other hand, we've never had a candidate quite like Joe Biden, somebody who's been on the national stage for so long and is so familiar that he doesn't really need to introduce himself to voters the way that a new candidate like Barack Obama did in 2008. Biden doesn't really have to convince people, hey, I'm qualified to be president, because he's been vice president for 8 years. He's been a senator for 140 years or something like that. And so he has very well-known name recognition. People have a very clear idea of who Joe Biden is, moderate Uncle Joe, whatever, whatever. And so he can kind of camp out in his basement. And as long as he's leading in the polls by 10, 12, 14 points, he can essentially run an incumbent's campaign and just say, hey, vote for me, I'm Joe, time to put me in charge.
Well, and a big difference is, as you write in your story, is about, you know, incumbents, you know, going after undecided voters in the middle, right? And that's what's missing from Trump.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, look, there's a reason that incumbent presidents of both parties, going back 100 years, tend to do the same thing. You roll out a big second-term agenda. You bring in government, business, bigwigs into the Oval Office. You kind of flaunt the power that you have in the bully pulpit and sort of establish the conditions by which voters think, you know, that guy looks like he's in charge of things. Let's give him four more years. That's worked for every president, you know, except for George H.W. Bush and Jimmy Carter in my lifetime. And, you know, because incumbency has a real measurable advantage. So it's sort of interesting that Trump has chosen to forego those potential advantages. I mean, he can, you know, call a nationally televised address. You know, he can reach out. You know, he can start a jobs program. There are things that you do in a big recession that Trump is just not doing. And by failing to do those, I think that helps explain why it is that swing voters, voters in the middle, at least right now, according to the polls we have, are primarily siding with Joe Biden.
So, Josh, I mentioned the artwork, and for those who haven't seen it, and because this is obviously a radio program, the art department superimposed a Biden face on Trump and a Trump face on Biden to get this point across. And I'm wondering if that's still haunting you, Josh?
It is haunting my dreams and my nightmares. I tweeted out the image on my Twitter feed a little while ago. If anybody wants to check it out, and I'm pretty sure it's at Business Week, online and in print. But it is weird. The face swapping is a very vivid visual representation of the broader idea I was trying to get at here, and one that you will not be able to shake from your mind for better or for worse.
And so, Josh, the unusual nature of this campaign, we got to talk about that as well, that sort of Biden in the basement in many ways and Trump not being able to do these rallies. How much of that atmosphere or lack of atmosphere is contributing to sort of the topsy-turvy nature of this?
I think it's contributing a huge amount because, the problem for Trump is that right now the election is a referendum on Donald Trump and things aren't going real well, not in the public health sense, not in an economic sense. And so he needs to sort of switch tack and make this a choice election between Trump and Biden. Which one do you like? Which one do you trust? Which one is better suited to run the economy? That's what Trump's campaign is trying to do. But it's difficult, as you said, because Trump, you know, held one sort of aborted, fitful stadium rally. Doesn't look like there's going to be any more anytime soon. He can't use the traditional methods that he did in 2016. And he just doesn't seem inclined, as I point out in this piece, to behave in the way a normal president would and use the Oval Office, use the White House bully pulpit, use the Rose Garden to try and make those distinctions. And because Biden is so far ahead in the polls, he doesn't really have any pressure on him to get out there and get in front of voters and risk making a gaffe, making mistakes, saying something offensive that could weaken his support. And so here we are on what feels like a glide path toward a Biden victory, at least barring change. But of course, as we know, everything changes every 3 weeks.
Exactly. And I would never, you know, this is a president who and a candidate formerly who did things his own way and fooled all of us in terms of finding his way to the White House. So time will tell whether or not this will ultimately hurt him. In the meantime, it's an incredible read. Great reporting, Josh, as always. And I got to say, picture connected with the story that's in the magazine. It's online. Yeah, it's a little jarring. It makes me a little uncomfortable.
You look at me and go,
Please stop. Please stop. Yeah. Of course, Josh Green, national correspondent at Bloomberg Businessweek, on the phone from Washington. And our thanks to Joel Weber, Bloomberg Businessweek editor, on the phone in Massachusetts.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
We love talking to Andy Brown. Yes. He is the editorial director of Bloomberg New Economy, always looking at the whole world, our expert on China. He joins us on the phone from New Hampshire. I do want to start maybe in an unconventional way, though, Andy, if I may. I know you've been in New Hampshire now for a number of months. What does this all look like from there?
What does the trade war and all
no,
the tensions?
What is this crisis shutdown, look yeah. like? The shutdown, everything. Because I realize that we haven't really talked to you about that element sort of from a personal and professional perspective, because, you know, we hear from all these folks across the country. And I wonder what it looks like from your perspective, especially given how in touch you are with the rest of the world.
Yeah, so I don't know. From my vantage point here in Sunapee, New Hampshire, it seems that the United States has forgotten about the pandemic. Everybody is coming here on holiday. Nobody is wearing a face mask. Nobody seems to be thinking about social distancing. The good news, I guess, is that Americans are traveling again. And we were just talking, actually, at the New Economy Forum with the Airbnb CEO just a couple of days ago,
right,
telling us that business for Airbnb is roaring back. I got to say, though, I mean, overall, the rest of the world is looking at the United States, the lack of face masks, the lack of social distancing, the lack of a coordinated government response to this, and shaking its head and saying, you know, how is this possible, particularly in Asia, where this is just sort of it's a reflex now. It's a social reflex. People don't need to be told. And of course, we're seeing this now in Europe, which is about to take a decision on reopening and who's going to come in. And I'm afraid it looks like the United States is not going to be on that list, but China will be. And that's going to be a huge deal if Europe closes its doors to American travelers but opens them to the Chinese.
Huge.
God, like, you can't even get your head around something like that. You know, I love your column, and I'm going to just, you know, kind of switch gears a little bit, because, you know, we all tweeted out the pictures of the impact that the global pandemic had on our environment, right? We had a respite. We had clearer and bluer skies around the world. We were seeing, you know, mountains that we hadn't seen for a while. We talked about the skies in China that are certainly known, you know, for being very, very polluted, and we got a break. But that's changed again. And you write about this, Andy, in your column, how China is once again kind of retreating on climate change and what the impact of that will be, not just on our environment, but on its relationship again with the West, already a troubled relationship with the West. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so having lived in China for decades, I've kind of seen previous episodes of this, and the, you know, where suddenly Beijing's soot-filled skies turn blue, and when they turn blue, Beijing is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. You know, the first time was in 1993. China was hoping to host the Olympic Games, and an inspection committee from the Olympics came in, and the government ordered all the coal-fired boilers to turn off, and the city shivered for a couple of days, but the skies turned blue. And then something similar happened during the Olympics in 2008. And we've seen, as you say, something quite similar just a few months ago, where the Chinese economy went into lockdown, and all of those coal-fired power stations all around Beijing that belch smoke into the Chinese capital, shut off. And suddenly, you know, you had this, what now people now call Olympic blue. Unfortunately, every one of these episodes has been fleeting. And it's proved to be the case in the latest episode, where, you know, the Chinese economy is now roaring back to life. Carbon emissions are where they were before the lockdown. And the worst of it is that that carbon emissions are about to spike even higher. And this is because China is going back, local governments are going back to the tried and tested way of kicking off GDP growth, build coal-fired power stations. And the tension here, I think this is really going to set up a whole new area of tension with the West, because most of the West, or much of the West, is heading in exactly the opposite direction. You know, Britain hasn't burnt a lump of coal in weeks and weeks. It's the longest period without coal since the Industrial Revolution, you know, in the 1880s. The United States this year is going to be producing more power from renewables than coal for the first time ever, you know, or the first time in years and years. And
you know, Sweden, Austria, they're going to close down their last coal power, you know, stations. It doesn't really matter because China burns half the world's coal. And so, you know, it's neither here nor there. What happens, of course, in Sweden and Austria, China burning more coal is going to swamp all of those gains.
Hey, Andy, just got like 20, 30 seconds here. So just quickly, I mean, wouldn't these tensions have happened anyway just because the West is and has been for a while getting off of coal and China has not really showed any signs of slowing, just quickly?
You're right, but I think it's just the stark divergence now, where you know coal is really disappearing from the grids in Western countries, and in China it's making a comeback and will be exported through the Belt and Road Initiative. So you're going to get coal-fired power stations, fleets of these all over pristine sections of Central Asia, other parts of the developing world. China is the largest financier of mines and power stations in the developing world.
It's just a reminder why we do need everybody on the global stage to be talking with one another, especially the big powers, whether it's China, whether it's the United States, Europe.
Guess what's not happening?
Talking.
That.
Yeah.
That talking is not happening right
it's
now.
It's not.
All right, Andy Brown, thank you so much for keeping us honest on all things with the Bloomberg New Economy, joining us on the phone from New Hampshire.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
And it is time for the Drive to the Close. Back with us, Ryan Dietrich, Senior Market Strategist at LPL Financial, looking after about $670 billion that firm is. He joins us on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Ryan, always good to have you back with Carol and myself. And I'm going to start where I always start with you, which is, what's going on down in Charlotte? How is this all looking from your perspective? Personally, I feel like the last time we talked, keep me honest here, you were talking about, you know, maybe some youth sports starting up again and you know, sort of getting back a little bit. I wonder what's happened in the meantime.
Hey, Jason and Carol, thank you guys for having me back.
Hi.
That's right. You know, just tonight, in a couple hours, my son Sebastian has a baseball game, and tomorrow night, my son Gus has a soccer game. So we're slowly getting to that. It's weird, you know, because they don't have dugouts. The kids are all staying with the parents. We're all 6 feet apart. You know, there's no high fives and things like that. So there's some parts of normalcy coming back, but I still go to the office every once in a while, and there's nobody on the road still. It's still a ghost town, it seems like, from that point of view. But I guess just the fact that the kids' sports are slowly starting up, and honestly, we are in South Carolina, so I think we all know we're a little more lax, maybe, I guess, about kind of some of the things going on, and whether that's right or wrong, you look at some of the numbers that we can get into. It is scary because I don't necessarily know anyone that has it, but at the same time, we see the numbers, and it continues to go higher. But we are getting some normalcy back here, watching our kids play some sports.
Right. So we're getting to do that, which does make us feel more normal. But when you look at the markets, the bounce back that we've had, and then you look at the economic data points, the earnings projections, something we just talked about with Dave Wilson, that there seems to be, you know, more companies coming out and being more optimistic about their earnings outlook. You know, does it make you feel more positive about the financial markets or more cautionary considering the bounce back that we've had already?
Yeah, Carol, I guess we'd be a little more cautious because, you know, I became one of you guys in April and May, and we were quite bullish then, and that's when everything was bad, right? All the negativity out there. Wouldn't it be something if after this, you know, 40%+ rally that we've had, now the economic, look at the housing data today. My goodness. I mean, most of the data we're seeing is coming in much better than expected. Wouldn't it be something if this is kind of where the market takes a break? And I love
it. But I will say, just like Yelena Shalateva, our Bloomberg economics economist, she said after I said, wow, look at that number, she goes, yeah, but it's after 2 months where we fell off a cliff. So we have to, you can't just look at 1 month data point. You've got to look at it in context of what the economic backdrop and environment have been over the last couple of months, right?
Exactly. I mean, most of the economic data points 2 months prior were some of the worst we've ever seen. So you're coming off historically low levels, but it's still a positive thing. But at the same time, look at history. You know, March of 2003, major market low, rallied like mad for a few months, consolidated in the summer. March of 2009, major market low, huge rally for a few months, consolidated in the summer. Here we are once again, that month of March. Obviously, we know we've had one of the greatest three-month rallies in history here. And we think it makes sense what Mark Twain say, right? History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Maybe markets can consolidate, maybe even pull back, you know, 10%, which wouldn't be that bad after a 45% rally, and then eventually work their way higher. That's what happened in 2003 and 2009. We wouldn't be shocked at all if it happened once again.
So, Ryan, you know, we caught up with Josh Green, our fantastic national correspondent for Business Week, earlier in the show, and he was reminding us, not that we necessarily needed a reminding, but I feel like some folks do. It is a presidential election year. We are moving closer and closer. You guys down around the Charlotte area are all too aware of some of the politics around conventions and whatnot. But it is a presidential election year. I do wonder how soon you start to factor that into your investment calculus, or are you already?
Yeah, we're not quite factored in quite yet, because clearly what the market is wanting to see is the reopen. I mean, we know that, right? The data continues to show more and more cases, but the reopening is what Mr. Stock Market was really excited about. But yeah, you mentioned the election. And interestingly enough, the stock market is one of the best indicators we have for who's going to win that election. We took a look, and if you look at how the stock market does by the S&P 500, if it's up 3 months before, the incumbent party tends to win. And if it's down 3 months before the election, the incumbent party tends to lose.
Yeah.
It's been right every single time since 84, higher. It's been right 87% of the time, 20 to 23 times, going back to 1928. So the reality of the fact is when that clock starts here, depending on where you are, how stocks are doing might give that clue as to who will win the election in November and be in the White House next January.
Ryan, what's more important to the markets, though? Is it the election? Is it the virus and the economy getting back on track? I mean, is it both and they're connected?
Yeah. Well, we think at this point it is the virus, right? I mean, we think if you look at the numbers, we know it's a surge in cases. We get it. But the surge in hospital stays is starting to trickle higher, but nowhere where we saw in April. Unfortunately, the number of deaths. Now, I know deaths lag the cases, but still, we're not seeing those. I mean, we're much more ready to fight this, I think. And we do think the stock market is telling us, you know, that maybe there could be better economic data ahead the second half of the year. But if there's anything we've learned this year, it's the economy and the stock market don't always drive. In fact, they haven't drived at all much this year. So, again, kind of like my big themes earlier, maybe the economy gets better and the market takes a break. But there's no question as we get closer to the election, we're going to start breaking all those things down. But I always point this out. After President Trump won, everyone thought steel and coal would do very well. They haven't. I mean, it's never so obvious as to what's going to happen. If everyone's talking about it, it's probably priced in. We've had bear markets and bull markets under Republicans and Democrats. At the end of the day, economy is doing is what matters more. If the economy keeps opening up, hey, it might not matter who's in the White House. We still see this market go higher in 2021.
That's very true. All right, going to leave it there. Ryan Dietrich, thank you so much. Senior market strategist at LPL Financial, $670 billion in assets under management, on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.